Welcome to the Mid-Range Podcast. My name is Jacob Weiss. I'm here with my co-host Nick Geramonte, and we're happy to welcome on a very special guest, first guest in the history of the show, owner of Bracketeer.org, does work for Field of 68 and Basket Under Review, Rocco Miller. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing amazing. Doing good. As we said before, like we were saying, we're just starting this podcast up. We have nothing, and we're just sent you a DM out of nowhere because I'm a big fan of your work, and it means a ton for us to have you on, and we're just excited to talk some basketball.
I love it. I am too. I mean, I've been stuck in the scheduling world for the last 7 months, and it's been fun. You know, I got on the road last week, did SoCon Media Day was kind of the big day, but I hit 5 different practices at different levels, you know, everybody from LIU Brooklyn to Georgia State to Appalachian State. So it was a fun adventure. Good to be back home this week just to kind of get organized before, like, next week we'll have WCC and Mountain West Media Day, and just got done with Conference USA and OVC today. So it's just like, if you follow all 31 leagues like me, there's never a dull moment. So we keep it exciting.
Yeah, well, you mentioned going back home. You're based in Oakland right now in the Bay Area. We're both from the Bay Area, as we talked about before, and you have some Seattle ties. So West Coast guy, they don't really talk about West Coast when it comes to college basketball a whole lot. So I just want to ask you, how did you get into college basketball at the start and really, really find that love for it?
Yeah, good question. So I grew up, born and raised in Seattle. But was there, you know, all through like college years and into my 20s a little bit, and then finally moved down to California since then. But when I was growing up, we had the Kingdom, especially when I was little. And so I just feel super lucky to be part of that generation, because in 1995, we had Ed O'Bannon and UCLA win the national championship in Seattle. I think my parents took me down there daily. Like they had all this fan fest stuff set up, as you know, if you've been to recent Final Fours, it was still the same in the 90s, and my dad and I would just play college basketball trivia like as much as possible when we were down there. We did that in 89 when I was really little. Michigan won the national title with Glenn Rice and Ramil Robinson back then, and in between those Final Fours we also had like multiple regionals. So 93 the Fab Five came to Seattle, which was unbelievable, you know, at my age, at, you know, as a little guy, to see them up close. We got tickets to those games, and Yink Adare was, I mean, this is like old school stuff, but like in 92, 7-foot center for George Washington, they were a 12 seed, pulled off 2 upsets, almost beat the Fab Five, and then Temple almost beat the Fab Five in the Elite Eight. All those games were like down to the wire, incredible games. And that whole time, like almost all those years, Washington was terrible at basketball, like bottom of the Pac-10. So all me and a bunch of my close friends growing up, we all had a soft spot for the Huskies, but we always watched college basketball nationally. So I kind of pulled for Syracuse was my team, because when I was little, I got like $40 for them making the championship game. And, you know, when you're a kid, 40 bucks is like tons of money. I think I made it last a few months on candy and whatnot. But I mean, I just remember watching the Big East, you know, all through my childhood. And then I had buddies that were Kansas, North Carolina, Duke. Like, so we watched everybody. And that's just the way I've always seen the sport. And then as I got older, I started, you know, this thing called bracketology started, thanks to this guy named Joe Lunardi on ESPN in the late 90s. And then, you know, I didn't really think a lot of it. Like many people, I was impressed with the popularity, and it actually made sense to start following the whole season from the lens of bracketology. Like, what does this win mean? What does this loss mean? You know, how does a team from a non-power conference actually get an at-large bid? So really just trying to figure out the process. And by like the time Twitter launched in 2010, I had kind of started doing my own like handwritten notes, really just because I love the sport, just pure love. Didn't expect it to ever go anywhere. And then my Twitter account, I just started making it mainly about that about 15 years ago. And what I think what that allowed there to be was a track record I basically started looking at the process a little bit differently, made sure I never really lost to Joe, even though we're friends now. And I basically just kind of retraced the steps of what every committee member talked about. And that helped me be a little bit more accurate than kind of anybody publicly. And that generated like a way bigger following. And then by 2015, I launched my website. It just kind of took on a life of its own, but I wanted everybody to know that I'm much more than just a bracket forecaster. I actually really love, you know, getting a chance to watch all the different levels of college basketball. And also, you know, there's no greater event than March Madness. So even though I might not cover the Big 12 or the SEC all season long, I'm keeping up with it just as much as you guys. And I'm ready to rock when I'm covering the NCAA tournament, watching a lot of those film. And I will catch an occasional game as well, like I did the Arizona State game last year, which was absolutely chaotic with Caleb Love getting headbutted.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's just the gist of it. And now I'm just trying to spread my wings as far as I can and, you know, cover as much as I can. But I'm only one guy. So it's just been a great journey. And college basketball is full of amazing people. And that's been the best part of it.
It totally cracks me up. You and all your buddies coming from Seattle, it's like rooting for like the Premier League. It's like you just pick, everyone picks a good team because it's like, it's not like Washington's going to do shit anyway, right?
That's what it felt like in those years. And then when we were like college age, that's when all of a sudden these great teams came to be under Lorenzo Roman. So that was unbelievable. Right. Like in 05, we went down to the Pac-12 championship game. Which, you know, the famous one's 2011 when Isaiah Thomas hit the step back shot, cold blooded. But in 05, that was also a classic game between Washington and Arizona. Nate Robinson against Salim Stoudemire. Stoudemire went for 37, but the Huskies still won the game and then got the number one seed that year. And then the 06 team, of course, even though Washington was a 5 seed, they probably should have gone to the Final Four. They got robbed a little bit by the refs in the UConn game. And, of course, George Mason knocked off UConn in the Elite Eight. So we should have probably had Washington, George Mason in the Elite Eight, which would have been phenomenal. But, yeah, I mean, it was really cool to see the entire city of Seattle get behind the team when they finally figured some things out during that time.
Yes. I want to touch on Romar just a little bit because you brought him up. Like, he's always been a top recruiter, and you obviously cover the WCC, and he had some great rosters at Pepperdine. Why do you think it hasn't really turned out for him as well as it may have could have?
Well, I mean, he had a great career at Washington. I mean, he's arguably the greatest coach in school history, going to three Sweet 16s, I think six NCAA tournaments in his 17 years. And you know, the Washington's history was so down. So from a Seattle point of view, he was unbelievable, and he was able to recruit with all, during that era, he was able to recruit with anybody, just bring in the kind of NBA players that came through the program, Terrence Ross and Isaiah Thomas. Brandon Roy was probably destined to be an NBA Hall of Famer if he didn't get his knee injured. There's a long, long list of great players at Washington. By the time he went back to Pepperdine in his older years, just, you know, in recent years up until 2 years ago, it's a different job there. You know, like at Pepperdine, you're bottom of the bottom half resource wise in the West Coast Conference. He was still able to get some really good talented players. You know, Kessler Edwards is in the NBA right now. Houston Millett was a great player there. He's now on Alabama. He was still a great recruiter, but I just think Romar was always such a player's coach. He kind of lost any kind of defensive edge. I think at Washington he had the athletes to just overwhelm people defensively, so it didn't become such an issue, especially during the heyday. But later in his career, like at Pepperdine, you would need a defensive strategy to slow down the Gonzagas, the St. Mary's, and beyond, and he just didn't have that type of depth. Or the defensive pedigree at that point. So a little bit of the game changing and him just kind of going into a retirement job that he was comfortable with. Yeah. But he's still at LMU. Also, he's still at LMU right now. So we'll see.
It is that Washington, you know, Seattle area, that talent pool too is absurd when you talk about like some of the best like national high school basketball in the country. It's incredible the talent that they produce year after year. So many top NBA guys. And like, if you can siphon off your section to come over to Washington, then you can have a super strong team just building through the region.
Right, and that's how it worked. I mean, a lot of those dudes were just totally local guys. John Brockman was a guy who played in our high school league and dominated. So it was unbelievable to see him go into the Pac-10 and do it there. Because really, like in Snohomish County, Washington, we don't send a lot of guys to Division I at all. And to see one not only get to Division I but dominate a power league was... That was cool, but obviously a lot of the inner Seattle guys that we've mentioned, Will Conroy was a great point guard. That team in like 04, 05 was really, really special. Nate Robinson's a Rainier Beach kid, Will Conroy, a Garfield kid, yeah. Brandon Roy, a Garfield kid, Anthony Washington, Garfield. It was literally all Seattle. So that was special. And the reason why they came back from 0 and the year before, they played – from like completely out of the tournament picture, nobody talking about them, started Pac-10 play 0-5 to steamrolling the rest of the schedule and beating Stanford, who was 26-0 on the final day of the season. That's to this day probably the best Washington home game I ever went to in my life, because it shocked the college basketball world, and the team was just on fire. The place was unbelievably loud. I think they could have beaten anybody that day. You know, that was like pinnacle Seattle stuff. Nowadays, you know, this is an exciting team they'll have this year, but it's built completely differently. It's pure dollars and cents. The exciting guys are, you know, Filipino and German for the freshman guys. And then we got a, you know, couple USC players, and it's all over the map. So, but it's still exciting.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, you broke the news on a lot of mid-major conference winners in the first round of what an expanded tournament may look like. Can you just kind of give more clarification on to the likelihood, which seems like inevitable at this point, of an expanded tournament and what exactly that format will look like?
Yeah, so, I mean, I read through the fine print finally last week when I believe Yahoo was the first to report this likely change to 76. I think that part of it is basically approved already. Now the next mystery is, how is it going to work? What's it going to look like? And once I dove into that, and there's a model that's pretty far down the road to being approved, I wanted to get a visual out there for the audience, because I think that's important. And how everybody reacted to it, of course, very unpopular. Not, and I don't take that personally, because in so many ways I agree with the audience, but effectively what it means is you're adding eight more teams to the field, and next year we will get the Pac-12 back, and it will be a great basketball league with Gonzaga and San Diego State leading the charge there. So we'll have 32 automatic qualifiers across 32 conferences. And outside of that, to get to 76, you need 44 at-large teams, which is drastically different than the 37 this year. And so effectively what that means is the last 12 teams into the at-large pool will have to go to either, it sounds like they'll have two sites. So Dayton will remain a site, and then they're choosing between a few options in the West. Let's just pretend it's Las Vegas. I think that's
a city. Vegas,
it makes the most sense. It could be Salt Lake City or Denver, or Arizona, but I do think Las Vegas makes the most sense, as you said. So you would have effectively six playing games, three in Dayton, three in Vegas, just to finish the at-large pool. But then the other half of that is you'll have another 12 of the lowest 32 automatic qualifiers. And I think that's the part that's rubbing a lot of fans the wrong way, because now you're taking a much higher threshold of team that has to go play an opening round game than just those bottom four. Now it's the bottom 12. And that's the visual I posted on X / Twitter is, last year that would have meant UNC Wilmington, who played an incredible game against Texas Tech and just fell short, had the lead for a lot of that game. Robert Morris, of course, famously played Alabama like tooth and nail for 39 minutes. They would have been an opening round team. And then like Wofford, who came from a really good conference, the SoCon, and was on fire when they entered the tournament. Played pretty well against Tennessee. Those are the types of teams that would all have to play opening round games in this model. And I think that's going to take a while for people to wrap their head around. So the more visuals I can put out there and get, you know, because I think public perception is a really important part of this. Until it's 100% approved, I might as well share some of those things early. If there's enough pushback, like I wasn't expecting that one tweet to go as big as it did, but that's the whole purpose of it is to just, let's get this information out and see if there's anything we can do about it, if this is the right path forward or not. But it does seem like the ship has sailed significantly. And what that's going to mean is with the at-large games, basically all the 12 seeds are going to be opening round winners, and then probably a couple of the 11 seeds and sometimes spills into the 13s, could also start as high as the 10s, just depending on how many quote-unquote bid steals we get during championship week.
Yeah, and you
It's interesting.
You go.
Go ahead, Mac.
I was going to say, like, that goes along, too, with we've seen ref share and obviously NIL and all that kind of stuff really change the power difference. I think you put out a tweet, 79 power conference teams are in the top 96 of the first KenPom rankings this year. How much of a divide really is there in college basketball right now, and do you think that plays an impact into this style of tournament expansion?
Yeah, I think all of it's related for sure. Now, where the dots connect is really kind of up to interpretation. I think in the KenPom model, you know, one of the things it illustrates is the divide in funding for these programs and in how they acquire talent to play at these programs. And, you know, my colleague over at Basket Under Review, Kevin Sweeney, I've been friends with for years. He made a really good point the other day where, you know, if you think Boston College is the worst power conference team, which you could make that argument, or what it could be Penn State, it could be Arizona State, whoever you think that is, if you stuck them into the A-10 or the American, they would still probably have a chance to be in the top five for sure in those leagues and maybe even win those leagues. And that just kind of goes to show how loaded all these power conference teams are. You know, I think it starts with the simple premise of following the money. Like, if you're a Big Ten player and you're the 10th highest paid player on your roster, you're probably still making more this season than the best player on most Big West teams or the best player on most SoCon teams. And that's exactly how a lot of these kids make their decision to transfer. You know, if they see themselves as probably never going to be an NBA guy, would love to play overseas, you know, into my 20s and 30s for my pro career, but there's no guarantee of that either. I got to get my money now. I'll go be the 11th best guy, you know, at Pittsburgh and take my chances. Maybe I'll play well and play my way into the rotation and then play my way into a really prominent role, betting on myself. Plus, I have the insurance of making this money right now. Versus, I can go be the best player at Western Carolina University, but maybe the season goes sideways, I get in a fight, I never get a paycheck, and you know, nobody's interested in it anymore next year. So it's a risk reward on an individual level, and it's trickled up into the team level because now these rosters are so incredibly deep that the Power Five teams in general can absorb 1, 2, 3, 4 either injuries, suspensions, what have you, and they're still going to be highly competitive. And the fact of the matter is these great mid-major programs from over the years, I love the Missouri Valley. There's programs now like Liberty and High Point and McNeese that are very well-funded, very competitive, but they can't withstand that type of depth issue if they lose 2, 3, 4 guys. They also can't retain the players that the high majors can. And so as soon as a guy makes the all-conference team, they're gone. And so that's just the reality. So the big reason why upsets used to happen all the time was the continuity. UC San Diego somehow pulled it off last year. They're a little under the radar, first year eligible, and they were able to keep all their seniors. That's going to be the exception, not the norm, and it certainly was last year. That's even harder to do year after year and to raise that money. So I think what you're seeing in the KenPom, which again, KenPom, you have to remember, is a power ranking tool. You're trying to evaluate how you know, what the threat level of each team is by looking at their KenPom ranking, not necessarily how many wins they're going to get per se, because there's other margins that determine that. We've seen years where, you know, Providence got a 4 seed. They couldn't crack the top 50 in KenPom. We've also seen Penn State crack the top 50 and not win half their games. So the whole point of it is like the strength of your team. So I think it's a good indicator of where things stand across college basketball with those 79, all 79 power conference teams being in the top 96. It's laughable, but it is very reflective of where we're at.
And is that something you see as a modern problem with that could be solved with more investment in mid-major programs by NIL funds and the sort? Or is that something that's just going to continue getting worse as years goes on, and we're just not going to see as much, as many stories, as many Cinderellas as we've seen in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine it getting much more divided than it is now, based on the fact that and there could be a split between the power leagues. Like, you could make the argument right now that the Big Ten and the SEC are clearly above the other three in terms of overall resources trickling over from football.
Definitely.
Right? And then you have the Big 12, the ACC, and the Big East in that next umbrella. And ideally for us in the West Coast, that new Pac-12 can fit into that group as well. But from there, you have another group, which is the West Coast Conference, the Mountain West, the A-10, and the American. And it just depends how invested they are. Like, the A-10, I think, has a real chance because I've seen what a lot of these programs did this offseason. You know, George Washington put a ton of money into their team. So did St. Louis. VCU and Dayton are already established, you know, but high budget, ready kind of for the next invite if the Big East ever calls. Type of programs already. Loyola Chicago is very invested. St. Bonaventure with Woj and all those guys, very invested. So I'm encouraged by the direction of the Atlantic 10 specifically. But with the WCC getting bruised and losing Gonzaga, potentially St. Mary's sooner than later, if St. Mary's can get into the pack, that's going to hurt the league. The Americans already struggling besides Memphis. Yeah. And I do think the Mountain West, you know, they'll have New Mexico and Grand Canyon and UNLV to get it going. But the rest of that league is very shaky. So it's really going to be kind of on a place-by-place basis rather than a league-by-league basis. And I think everybody else, like, you look at it from a total player pool perspective. If the there's still avenues to build good rosters, right? Like, Kennesaw State's a good example. They're based in Atlanta. They keep getting unbelievable freshmen that eventually will play Power Five. Like, you'll see Adrian Woolley kill it for Louisville this year.
Yeah.
I got to cover him last year. But, like, they can get guys like that as freshmen now because the bigger schools would prefer to let those guys start at a mid-major and kind of prove themselves before they'll take them. In the meantime, you got the Illinois of the world taking all these overseas guys. Now there's a bunch of them across the big leagues. And that's going to allow, like, the player pool, there's still talent to be found. It's just who wants to outwork who for that talent. And then, of course, you're limited resource-wise. So it's not like Kennesaw State can go get a guy from the German Pro League right now, like Illinois can. But they can get a four-star freshman, which makes a big difference in Conference USA. So it's interesting because you only have so many spots on every roster. And if everybody at Division I level is doing their job, there should be enough fruit to go around and make all these other levels still competitive.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting switch in how teams are being built in current college basketball, where you see a lot of high major teams. Like, I think Rick Pitino said a couple years ago that he's not going to even look at taking freshmen. And, like, I cover TCU. There's a very good chance that they don't pick up a freshman coming into this next class. But then you see other teams still building, like, especially your top-tier programs getting these five stars. I guess my question is just, what's your opinion on the complete no freshman build for these high major teams, and do you think it's smart for more teams to adapt?
Yeah, I think the no freshman teams at the high major level, it's usually because it's been going on for a few years at that level now. It usually is an indicator to me that the coach is worried about his job. And he's not going to go down with, like, a freshman or a younger player, especially one that he hasn't gone through the wars with, You know, so redshirt freshman would be excluded here, but you'd rather go down with 20 to 23 year olds than an 18 or 19 year old in a key role. So you hear the phrase all the time, get old and stay old. That's how a lot of mid-major teams have become successful year in and year out. They won't take a chance on freshmen. Some of those middle of the pack teams, you know, maybe like your Georgias, your Nebraskas, you know, those types of teams that are kind of projected bubble teams have sort of been floating around the bubble these last couple of years. Oklahoma is another example. They'll choose to just stay old, and that's like the safe way out because they can afford it, and there's quality and there's proven quality because those guys will come from somewhere where they averaged, you know, 15 a night, five rebounds, whatever that, you know, whatever void they can fill. It's a known commodity. But these bigger, even bigger programs like your Arkansas, your Floridas, Kentucky's, et cetera. And Kentucky, maybe not the best example because Pope did stay old last year. But I think eventually they do want to mix in some five-star talent because you can find some real dudes. Like, obviously, Peterson at Kansas could be the best freshman in the country. Duke can build a whole starting five out of freshmen, right? So they're getting the cream of the crop guys in each class at those places. And so it'd be silly for them not to take some of these players that could, you know, Cooper Flagg was the player of the year last year, 18, 19 year old kid. Right. So there's a place and a home for them at the high major level. It's just, if you're, you know, in that middle of the pack range and you don't have the access to them like Kansas, Arkansas, Duke do, you're probably better off just taking an older player in the portal. And I think that's where you see some of the different decisions made there. The other thing I'll add is all of these places, for the most part, especially in the Big Ten and the SEC, have general managers now. So they're on the front line of, like, understanding what this kid might want to make, if they can, if you know, what they should offer, if it's realistic to even bring them in. And then they're evaluating players with these expanded staff. So a couple of years ago, they went from three assistants full-time that can recruit to five assistants full-time that can recruit. And I think that's giving the high majors even more advantages because – A, they're nailing these hires. These guys are very sharp. A lot of them came from mid-major, so a lot of them I know just from building relationships with them at lower levels. And they're not missing nearly as often with the evaluations. There's so many great tools out there to kind of break guys down by on-off splits, different combinations of lineups, how you want to utilize them. So they know so much before they even offer or call the kid. And they're not missing on evals really anywhere. So that's making it even harder on the mid-majors because there's just too many advanced analytics to miss nowadays.
And with that advanced analytics and the thresholds that you want these certain guys to reach in mid-majors to bring them into your power game and try to make a run for a national championship or a Final Four at a higher level, you mentioned a guy like Adrian Woolley who goes to Louisville from Kennesaw State, and he's a guy who has pretty big expectations and should be a bucket for them this year. What other guys around the Power Five this year are going to be contributors for Final Four contenders, national championship contenders that come from the mid-majors that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, man, there's a good amount of them, obviously. You know, Florida last year kind of gave the blueprint. I think almost every starter played mid-major at one point or another, obviously with Walter Clayton coming from Iona, and Will Richard coming from Belmont, and Martin coming from Florida Atlantic, and Han Gloten's from Marshall, you know, and obviously he's still there. So there's a big list there. And Florida this year will have a kid from Ohio U play a pretty key role, I think, off the bench. But, you know, so if you're looking at the Gators again, you can account him with Xavier Lee as the obvious choice coming from Princeton. Player of the year in the Ivy League, just an humble. If you don't know who he is, you probably haven't been paying too close attention, because Xavier Lee's an unbelievable Ivy League level player. Curious to see how he can do at the national level. So Florida's done an amazing job of identifying those guys and putting a lot of trust in them. But yeah, like, I think at Ole Miss, they picked up a guy named Keza Giffa, who we liked a lot at the mid-major level, played for High Point, hit multiple buzzer beaters last year. So he's certainly a guy to look for. He's competing with Corin Johnson, a guy who sat out last year for the starting spot. I think Giffa will win that win that battle. Man, who else? We've got Texas A&M hired Bucky McMillan, and he's got some really sexy upside guys. Jakari Lane's one of them from North Alabama. I think he was the A-Sun Player of the Year last year. Certainly a projected starter and will run the show at times for the Aggies. If you're familiar with Samford basketball, they'll play like a very up and down system, which will be really unique in the SEC. So excited to see, you know, he's kind of the main guy coming from mid-major level, but Rashawn Agee, you know, a while back in his career. And of course, Ali Adu Diba comes from Southern Illinois. Josh Holloway came from Samford. So they've got a good list of former mid-major players at Texas A&M. That's a team with tremendous upside, but also like a huge variance because we're not sure exactly how it's going to work against these superior teams. Final Four level, you know, you look at, you know, Alabama, right? They've got a chance always under Nate Oates. And I think, you know, we talked about Houston Millett earlier. He's had to sit quite a bit since he got there. I think they're really going to be counting on Houston this year. Came from Pepperdine. You also look at Noah Williamson, Patriot League Player of the Year last year. Came from Bucknell. Averaged 17 and almost 8 rebounds a game and almost 2 assists a game. So they can run a lot of offense through Noah when they choose to. They've got different front court combinations that they can use there at Bama. But I've always liked Nate Oates' knack for finding mid-major players as well, much like Todd Golden. They'll also bring in a kid, Bristow, from Tarleton. If you know anything about Tarleton basketball under Billy Gillespie, that's on your in-your-face ball pressure defense. Nearly every player on the floor will average a steal a game and a block a game because they are right in your face. So that's going to help as Alabama looks to, you know, kind of fix their defensive issues. As you know, they had that crazy game with BYU last year where it was just nonstop three-pointers. I think they want to clean that up a little bit this year. So those ones come to mind right away, but you can find examples in each league, especially the power leagues, where they're going to be dependent on mid-major to high-major transfers.
Speaking of mid-majors, who, like, obviously we talked about how it's such a dominant power conference team in today's college basketball, but who are some mid-major teams that you like to get tournament bids and really be dark horses during the season?
Yeah, well, you got to start in the Mountain West, right? Like, so the Mountain West has put 4 in last year. The magic year of 2 years ago, they had 6, and then 4 the year before. You know, this year, I think they project to be a little bit less certain. But the bonus is getting Grand Canyon, because every game at Grand Canyon should be a quad one game. That's an extra quad one game for nearly everybody in the top of the league. I think the Mountain West did get the schedule right, to where all the contenders will play a road game at Grand Canyon. Now, whether Grand Canyon's a tournament team or not, we'll have to see. They do have some ingredients that give them some upside. But my surprise pick in the league is Utah State to win the league. And that's mainly because Mason Falslev, he's a Power 5 level player that just happens to be from Logan, Utah, and is in love with the place, doesn't want to move, and he's basically staying there for less money. They are giving him a little bit, but it's nothing compared to what he could have made. That's an amazing story for the Mountain West level. And they have a tremendous graduate level, I guess, what do you call that, fifth-year player. Drake Allen running the point. He's been all over Utah himself. So those two have tremendous chemistry. Drake Allen was second last year in assist rate in the Mountain West in limited usage. He'll get more usage this year. The year before that, he was second in the WAC at Utah Valley in assist rate. And the year before that, he was ninth in the WAC at Southern Utah in the same WAC. So he's just gone from Utah school to Utah school to Utah school, but he's an amazing decision maker, great ball distributor, and a really good defender, underrated defender. And then you have Gary Clark, I think, is the real X factor for Utah State, a guy that was the best defensive rebounder in the Southland. That includes McNeese, all those studs that they had. Clark, of course, coming from the Islanders of Texas A&M, Corpus Christi, and he's a machine. I think he'll fit in perfectly with what Calhoun's trying to do. And I just think all these roles at Utah State, I could go down the list, but in interest of time, I'll just say that they're like, their roles are defined. Like, we know exactly what roles they're going to play. I think they're going to start the season on a great note. They have some early tests. I know they play VCU right there in Frisco, Texas, early in the season. So that'll be an awesome game for you to go to there.
Yeah, I got to.
Yeah, for sure. San Diego State's everybody's pick, and I do think San Diego State's definitely a tournament team. In fact, I might pick them to win the Mountain West tournament. But the reason I'm steering against them in the regular season is I don't think a lot of the national pundits out there realize that Magoon Gwat, their 7-foot star, the miracle story of the summer that he did not go to Kentucky or another high major school, he stayed, is partly because he's still hurt. He's not practicing still. I think he'll need at least a few weeks of practice to ramp up. We don't know when he's going to come back. There's a world where he doesn't play till January. And I think if the further into the season the Aztecs have to go without Gwath, the bigger the dent on their forecast for the season. Now, the backcourt is pretty dreamy. Like, you have proven commodities. Miles Bird's an NBA player. B.J. Davis has got the opportunity to go bonkers this season. Reese Waters is very good if he can come back from his injury. Of course, he missed last year as well. Yeah. And then Latrell Davis is a great transfer pickup, and so is Sean Newman Jr., Mr. Assist from Louisiana Tech. So they almost have too many guys in the backcourt, but I'm extremely concerned about their front court early on, and that's when they're going to play their biggest games in the Players Era Festival. And so that also brings Boise State, who's kind of like the tweener team for me, either first four Dayton type of team or last four out. Still deciding, but Andrew Meadow and Javon Buchanan are very good leaders back for them. And Leon Rice coaches his butt off, so they're gonna be tough. And the rest of the league, you know, there's a lot of upside at New Mexico. Eric Olin was probably the best hire anywhere at this level, if not the country, after the season he had. And they've got some pieces. Grand Canyon, we touched on. UNLV really loves their team. They have some amazing players with Kalani Hamilton, Miles Che, and the like. They're dangerous. We just don't know what Pastner and this new staff are going to do with these pieces. So I'll be very fascinated by them. And then Colorado State's pretty interesting with Aldi Farouk Manesh. They'll be a great home team, as always, in the altitude. I just don't – I'm not sold on them being a tournament team in year one, just based on the fact that they got a lot of guys they got to break in. So – I think that's where the Mountain West is. In the WCC, it's Gonzaga St. Mary's as always. Yeah, I think so. I think do you have a different opinion on that?
No, I just wanted to ask about St. Mary's a little bit, because it seems like RB's kind of avoided the mid-major wave and retaining talent probably more than the average mid-major team recently, but it seemed like it kind of hit more this year when you lose, obviously, Gustis and Mitchell Sachs and Luke Barrett, and then you have Jordan Ross hit the portal a year after Mahaney hits the portal, and it seems like they didn't really get the guys to come in. You're relying on a lot of freshmen and international guys, which I know St. Mary's obviously does a lot. But I'm interested to see – I saw they jumped into Lenardi's bracketology today after not being close to the bubble, which I thought was interesting. Where do you see the Gaels, personnel wise, tournament or no? I just want to ask for my own personal sake.
Yeah, I think they'll wind up in the top 30 by the end of the year and probably be in that 5-7 seed range once again.
I love it.
I mean, it's mainly because, you know, they have such a proven system and they find parts that fit the system. I know Jordan Ross is a tough loss, but Mikey Lewis is gonna step up big time, going on that freshman to sophomore leap, I believe. Tony Duckett had a good year in the WCC, and I think he'll get unbelievably better coaching at St. Mary's than he did at San Diego.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Morauskas, he's already an all-conference player. He'll continue to do what he did last year, if not even more. I think the real question's like, how many minutes can Harry Wessels play?
Yeah.
It seems like he gets gasped. Yeah, it seems like he gets gassed pretty quick, and hopefully he's worked on his conditioning this offseason. But you still have Andrew McKeever. So you have 2 7-foot-1 guys that you can just plug and play if you're Randy Bennett. And I love the way that he redshirts guys. So I think it's easy to forget that, like, Liam Campbell, Rory Hawk, Oliver Faber, they all redshirted last year. And usually when you redshirt at St. Mary's, you come back like a brand-new player with different levels of confidence, certainly better body. And, you know, one of the things that's a little bit of upside for the Gaels that's different is they have 2 4-star recruits, which I think they're two of the first 4-star recruits they've ever had in their history. So Dylan Shaw is like a top 100 player. He might have to use him this year, 6'7". Some people think he has a chance to start. And then Trent McClain's also a 4-star as well.
I like McClain.
You like McClain? Yeah, so I'm excited to get my eyes on some of those guys. I haven't seen them practice, so. But I do believe the formula is still the formula. Nobody's more prepared in the country than St. Mary's because of Randy and his staff. And, you know, as the season gets matured, you know, you see them drop some weird games in November sometimes.
Yeah.
Even December. But once things get matured and they start playing these WCC teams, they know all these teams, in a lot of cases, better than they know themselves. It's almost scary. I mean, I covered the game last year against Santa Clara when they went on a 30-0 run because and the reason why that run was possible is because they knew everything Santa Clara was good at, and they took it all away, and Santa Clara had no way to counter that. So they're just going to win games like that that other teams don't win because they're so well prepared.
Love it.
And then I think the rest of the league, like San Francisco, is extremely interesting to me. I got to see I did see them practice 2 weeks ago, and I like a lot of the pieces. Now how it comes together will be a different story. And they have a lot of great scheduling opportunities. I think they play up to 7. If they can get Washington in their tournament, they'll play up to 7 Power 5 teams, which is very difficult to schedule. So lots of opportunities for the Dons to build a resume. Tyrone Riley, of course, is the headliner because he might be a first-round pick in the NBA draft next year. I actually sat next to an Oklahoma City scout during practice. Got a lot of cool feedback about him because he's not necessarily a score-first guy. He just is an all-around playmaker. He can pass. He can defend. He'll get loose balls. He'll be in the right place at the right time, and he's only going to get better at that as a sophomore. It's a mini miracle the Dons got him back. And Ryan Beasley's a very steady point guard. And they did pretty well in the portal. Like, I'm pretty excited about Guillermo Diaz-Gran.
Being a
proven ACC center coming from Pitt. He's composed. He plays really well. He's kind of a quiet leader from what I observed. And there's a lot of other pieces I didn't mention. And they have a really good freshman from Seattle. In fact, it's Roydell Smiley's son, Legend Smiley. Roydell is a guy who played for Garfield back in the day with Brandon Roy. And Legend Smiley will for sure be on the court this year. He was probably the MVP of the practice I was at. So it's a really exciting team.
And a killer name is Legend Smiley is about as good as it gets from a name perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we see all these analytics, as we talked about too. KenPom, Evan Maya, all these seem to pop up. Which one do you value? And I feel like the committee came out last year and said that they do take into account KenPom. Which one do you value when you look most as a bracketologist?
So the official NCAA team sheets that the committee uses has both KenPom and Torvik on the sheets. So for my own process of guessing what I think the committee is going to decide, I certainly have to pay attention to both of those. Now, for me, my entire process is built on what I think the committee values and what I think the committee ultimately will vote on when they compare teams. So I have 20 different pieces of criteria. Like, the old school way of doing it would be, and I wish they still did, but last year proved that to be wrong, which I disagree with. But there's so many data points you can look at in terms of record away from home, record away from home against the top 2 quads, record away from home against quad 1, neutral court record versus away record. The whole point of being selected is proving that you can win away from home. The hardest thing to do in college basketball is win a true road game. So I feel like that's a very easy way to separate teams. And for multiple decades, that's how the committee did it. Now they seem to be a little bit more interested in metrics. And I think that's a trickle-down effect because the metrics typically support the bigger brands, which is why, you know, I think undeservedly Texas got in last year. I have a huge problem with Texas getting in last year. There was no precedent for that. And I think it's a sign of what's to come. And it's a little bit sad because I would have rather, I thought the UC Irvines and maybe even the Boise States of the world had deserved that spot. Texas is a team that lost 7 home games. It's embarrassing. So, you know, I think what I try to pay attention to, especially later in the season, is everything the committee cares about. So I don't leave any stones unturned. I do think other platforms like Evan Maya and Haslametrics and others have value to them. I'm also building game boards and doing my own analysis and previews. And those tools are extremely predictive, right? So predictive tools help with previews. But when I'm going back and I'm doing kind of a reconciliation of what's just occurred, I would prefer to just do my own analysis from, you know, box scores and whatnot. I do think KenPom's the easiest to use in general because it's really quick and easy to click around and see like who's best at 3-point percentage defense, who's making the most unforced errors in the turnover department, who can't shoot to save their butts. Like all that stuff you can find out in 5 seconds on KenPom. And based on the easy use, I tend to be on there the most.
That makes sense. I think it is fair to say that KenPom is just, it almost feels like it's completely taken over college basketball discourse. And
yeah.
It's like only baseline for everything. And because, it just gives you that cookie cutter way. So it's like, this coach in 9 of the last seasons outperformed this KenPom ranking. It's like, okay, whatever. That's all subjective, but beside the point. I want to get back to the mid-major conversation. I want to ask about a specific team that I fell in love with last year when I went to the MAC championship in Cleveland, Ohio, and I watched Miami versus Akron, and I watched Pete Sitter go out there and spray 6 threes on that ferocious Akron defense. And I spent the whole game being like, this guy is incredible. Ohio State needs to go steal this guy straight out of Miami's backyard. He returns. He was the MAC preseason player of the year. I believe Miami was the second ranked in the preseason poll. What do you think about Miami of Ohio basketball this year? And Sutter, I know he was on your second team for mid-major All-Americans, or your podcast at least. Where do you stand on him and that team going into the year?
Well, you said it all. Like, I think it's a miracle that they have him still. They ponied up in their own way to make that possible. There's a lot of excitement and scheduling about Miami, Ohio. A lot made by Travis Steele himself about how hard it was to get any games this year. Now, whether some of that's subjective, for sure. They definitely had games they could have taken and they didn't. But the MAC, you know, quite honestly, from top to bottom, out of the last 2 decades, it might be the worst overall MAC, last year at least, that I've ever seen, because the bottom was really, really bad. And it was very difficult to decide. And I happened to see Akron on a day when they got completely boat raced by Milwaukee in the Fiserv Forum at a triple header. I think they gave up 58 points in the first half. And so I had a hard time getting impressed with Akron last year. But I think what Travis has done at Miami, Ohio, is really impressive, because that program themselves, you know, even his first year on the job was really, really down. It took like a full rebuild. And you look at their top 6 guys projected this year, and they're all pretty key contributors, obviously led by Sutter. But Evan Ipsaro's back as the point guard. That's going to help a ton. Elmer is a really quality 4-man, or he can play the 3. Wolfolk is great in the middle at the MAC level. You know, he's only 6'9", but he's got a great body and he can throw it around and he's pretty efficient. Brant Byers, you know, helps with the front line as well and can also score. So they just have and shoot. Like, they have 4 shooters that are back that all shot over 40% last year. So they can bury these MAC games pretty early and often with big runs. And, you know, if you don't defend them correctly, they've been really skilled at floor spacing. So they're only going to be better at that this year. And I think the only transfer they took was Almar Atlason from Bradley. Pretty key guy, good glue, piece of glue there. Can also shoot it from deep. So they're going to have shooters all over the floor. He also brought in 5 freshmen. I would expect 1 or 2 of those to maybe pop. I picked Miami, Ohio to win the MAC. I've got them 17th overall in my non-power conference poll, which is basically just the one-bid leagues. But still, I've got Miami, Ohio 17, and I got Akron 21. But I do think the majority are picking Akron. So I've got my neck on the line a little bit for the Red Hawks.
I love it. I'm right there with you. Akron won that game, but I was so enamored. I was a few beers deep, but I was in love with the guy. I was like, I could watch this guy play all day. It was like 40 feet, just grab it and just shoot it, and like got two guys in his face. It's like, this is like Steph Curry.
Oh man, amazing. He's incredible. He's only going to get more confident too. I mean, being a good shooter is all about confidence, right? So the longer you can play in the same system and with the same guys, maybe Miami, Ohio can become that UC San Diego type team this year. I wish I could have saw them practice actually, but I'm curious to see how the season goes. Obviously getting to start off with that MAC challenge is really fun. Because it's not like most of the opening night games are duds. They'll play Old Dominion. At least it's interesting enough to see, just how good they can be. They get that game at home, so they should win it. And we'll see how much they can win it by. Some people love Old Dominion, so we'll see.
I want to talk a little bit more broad spectrum of college basketball. The AP Top 25 dropped this week. I was wondering if you had any takes. It's obviously a controversial list. But who do you think's overrated, underrated? Kind of what were your thoughts on the overall rankings?
I don't think I've ever looked at an AP Top 25 once in my life. I'll be honest, because we have this thing called the NCAA tournament at the end of the season. We have this thing called the selection committee that makes all the decisions that mean anything. Now, I will say, I want to say this about the AP 25. If your team gets ranked, it is a big deal, especially if it's a rare thing, right? Like, so if you're Kansas, Duke, whatever, doesn't matter. But if you're so go back to when Nate Oates coached Buffalo. I happen to be at the hotel with the team that morning. The poll comes out on Mondays during the season, right? Yeah. And I was with the team when they got the word that they were in the top 25. They had just pulled off a couple big upsets on the road, and they got ranked. And it was just like a fire alarm went off across the whole hotel because the AP will send a designated beat writer to your games. They'll write a story about all your games that goes on all the national newspapers, just goes on the AP wire, and all the attention you get for recruiting actually does move the needle at places like that. Or even if you're, like Ole Miss or something where you're not always ranked, it matters a lot. So I want to give it credit for that because it's a huge PR machine, and that's why, a lot of the public will react to it. You'll see millions of comments is probably why you're asking me the question. But the reality is like for all the work I do, it means absolutely nothing. So, if like UC San Diego gets ranked, I'll hype that for them because I know it means a lot.
Yeah. I love that. That's fair. I mean, it's kind of completely, it's funny. It gets a lot more hate in football, I think, than it does in basketball in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it means more in football for sure.
That's it, definitely.
And as a Washington football guy, it's been it's just another painful year for the polls for us. Yeah. Like we can't get ranked, and
you guys should 100% be ranked. That's complete bullshit. But that's a whole different conversation. Because if you were in the SEC and you lost to Ohio State level team, it would be a great win or a great loss, and then you actually move up in the ranking. So. Whatever.
I appreciate the sentimental piece there. Yeah. Got a lot of big games ahead, so we'll see. We'll see what happens from here. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. All right, Rocco. Well, we really appreciate you coming on. I think we're going to wrap up here shortly. But I did want to get a very, very, very way too early Final Four from you. If you had to pick right now, where are you going?
Well, I think my surprise, I might change my mind tomorrow, so I better say it now, but I think my surprise national champion is going to be Kentucky. I just think Mark Pope's system is so electric, and he didn't have really any, at least bona fide NBA players. I know a couple guys on that team will get two-way contracts and probably have good NBA careers eventually, but he didn't have a bona fide first-round pick on that team. This year's team's much, much more talented. Some of the guys he picked up from Europe, and if obviously most of these European guys need a year to adjust to college basketball and the physicality. But I think with, first of all, Otega Owe is kind of the glue. He withdrew from the draft, was probably their best prospect. Now he's back. Jalon Lowe was tremendous in the ACC. Denzel Aberdeen already won the national title at Florida. And then you got Quintance, which, I'm hearing he's fully healthy now. I have a good source that went to a practice last week. These guys are loaded like 1 through 11 with pros. So if Mark Pope gets this dialed in correctly, which I trust him to do, I think they can be an unstoppable force with all these weapons and the ability to rebound and the ability to defend. Those are just kind of some of the missing pieces. They had the shooting last year. Now they just have to do the other parts. And I think they've got it. So Kentucky is my surprise national championship pick. Okay. I think UConn's good enough to get back. So maybe UConn to the finals. And then I think the other two, it's just really hard to beat Houston. So I guess we'll stick with the Cougars for now until I do a deeper analysis. And then I think there's gotta be always like one kind of surprise pick. Typically, now last year was not that, but if you would have done it in the preseason, it would have been because Florida was 30th preseason. So I'll say my surprise team in this year, I'll say Tennessee finally breaks through. It's almost like a lifetime achievement award. They keep getting to the Elite Eight. I just like the way they win with defense and rebounding. I don't know. And I think Jacoby Gillespie, I got to cover him at Maryland in the NCAA tournament last year. I think that kid is unbelievable. And with Rick Barnes' leadership and the way they play, he'll be probably the best point guard talent-wise he's had. Nothing against Zakai Ziegler or some of the others. But I think Tennessee's got a lot of upside with tremendous defense.
Rocco, I got to ask, no Purdue in your Final Four. Do you have questions about Purdue this season as the consensus number one team in the country?
Or Big 12.
Well, I think Purdue's the most – well, I do have Houston in there, so –
Oh, you said Houston, my bad.
That's all good. I do think Texas Tech could have been that surprise team. I was actually torn with Tennessee and Texas Tech. But I would just say, sorry, where were we? What was the question one more time?
Purdue. Surprised to say Purdue.
Yeah, so part of that is – Purdue's basically got what we already kind of know what Purdue is. And I think that's why they're rightfully a number one overall, probably a number one seed, even in my own bracket when I do it, because they're never going to beat themselves. And there's not many teams that can just show up and make the adjustments needed to take advantage of any. There's really no holes on Purdue. But I do think there's teams that have better athletes, like Duke has better athletes. You could argue BYU has better athletes. Kentucky, I believe, is one of those teams. And so I just think it will be a matchup thing late in the tournament. I think they're almost a surefire Sweet 16 floor team, which is an extremely high floor. It's almost impossible for an 8 seed or lower to upset them. But the bottom line is winning 4 games in the tournament, I think at some point they get nipped in that, in like the regional semis or the regional final. It's just a gut.
But before we let you go, you've been covering college basketball for a while and got to make some cool relationships, I have, I'd imagine. Who are some of the favorite coaches you've encountered with, just not even based off their coaching style, but as personalities and just, just any cool stories you had along the way?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, at this point, I've had the luxury of meeting almost everybody at different points in time, whether I'm covering a game or just all the work I do in the off season for scheduling. I'm a consultant to help put games together at all levels. So I've been really, part of the reason I wanted to do that is to meet all these guys and build relationships with them. But it kind of started here in San Francisco, about a decade ago when Kyle Smith was the head coach. I lived close to Todd Golden at that time, the assistant coach. And, really, really fortunate to be part of that kind of Don's family. I lived less than a mile from the campus, started going to their games, eventually the practices. And Golden was one of the first people to invite me to practice. So obviously we know what happened from there, right? And Kyle Smith continues to be an extremely impressive head coach. If you go up and look up the history of Washington State University basketball, they've played for over 100 years of basketball. They've only made the NCAA tournament 7 times. So for Kyle Smith to take them to the NCAA tournament is an achievement that I don't think gets enough respect. He'll milk Stanford, even though they're severely under-talented compared to the top of the ACC, for all they can win there. And I think all the other guys, like, in that tree now, like Mike Baikpile is one of my favorite people anywhere in the world, not just basketball. He's now the Fordham head coach. He overachieved at UC Riverside for 5 straight years. That's one of the hardest jobs, if not the hardest, in all of California, let alone the Big West. And there's a lot of other pillars to that tree as well. As you see, you know, Kevin Hovde is the new head coach at Columbia. Super excited for Kevin. And also John Andrzejczyk, the new head coach at Campbell. So I start kind of with that local San Francisco tree. But as you know, all those guys originally are Randy Bennett guys, which just makes everything we've discussed on this show come full circle.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Rocco. Seriously. It means a ton for you to come on. Love your work. Been following it for a while. And thank you again for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate all the kind words. Happy to do it anytime, fellas. You can find, you know, bracket projections eventually are always going to be bracketeer.org. And then I think you've already shouted it out. We have our mid-major show on Field of 68. That'll be every Thursday throughout the season at 5 Eastern live. So really excited to get some juice behind that. We have the same production team as After Dark. And then also, last but not least, Basket Under Review has been an awesome platform. Going to continue to do pieces for them as well. So thank you.
Yeah, I've been loving that stuff.
Yeah, it's too bad we didn't get a chance to talk Chase Walker, the 300-pound beast, Columbus, Ohio kid. I was like, Ohio State should have had him. He should be playing right tackle and center for us this year. But I
guess that's right. He's our preseason player of the year on Field of 68.
There you go.
I know. It's a great pod. I very much enjoyed it. All right, really appreciate everyone who listened.
That sounds great.
Check us out on all platforms. Check Rocco out on all platforms. We'll see you next time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, see you, Rocco.
All right, take care.